Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Oh, bringing you some interesting, exciting new stuff. And today we're going to talk about sex. Always a good subject. A little while ago, I think it was last year, I ran into a book called Bonk, B-O-N-K, by Mary Roach. And Mary's in the studio with us today. Welcome to WBAI, Mary.
Thank you, Armand. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice. From California, finally got here. This is an exciting, exciting piece of work. Because, as you all know, we are researchers here at the DeMille Center and on The Positive Mind. I have in the studio with me also Stephanie Dombra. Stephanie, my assistant producer. Hey, Steph.
Hi. Hi. It's great to have Mary here.
Yes. Well, Stephanie is a therapist, has a big history in sex research, right? Tell me about your history, Stephanie.
Actually, my first master's degree is in human sexuality, and I also did work as an undergraduate, and I thoroughly enjoyed learning about human sexuality and coming into this book. It was really a great deal of experiences and enjoyment. I enjoyed reading this book tremendously.
Taking a degree in human sexuality, such a funny thing. It's like, what do we need degrees for? You know what I mean? Why do we need to study it? Well, from what I know of your work, it's not just about human sexuality. You study the entire human body. You look at all aspects of human chemistry. Now, this leads us to taking sexuality itself, highlighting it, putting it out, and saying, okay, maybe we could learn something about humans by the way they have sex. I mean, you know, if I were to look at a man, if you think about a kid looking at two parents having sex, and they look at the man grimacing and the woman screaming, what does the kid think is going on? You know, what is this agony, painful thing going on, and why is it going on? How is it interpreted? Well, somebody decided we go a little further and we're going to study sex. And over the years, people have studied sex for one reason or another. Some people studied it to disown it, to get rid of it. Some people wanted to call it evil. Some people decided that they would, you know, decide to cut off human parts, you know, or sew up places because of so-called research. But research into human sexuality has been done for myriad reasons, and Mary has studied this. Mary, teach us a little about what you found in the study of human sexuality, the science of it.
Sure. Well, human sexuality was a difficult thing to study as a science because, of course, it's a very personal and private thing, for one thing. And to bring a person or a couple into a laboratory and have them go through the sexual response cycle was an awkward thing, to say the least. Who do you get as your subjects, and how do you compensate them, or do you compensate them, and how do you deal with criticism and censorship, etc.? And also, what are you looking to find out? Early on, there was a lot of work that was tied in with fertility. It was safer to look at sexuality in the context of fertility. If a couple isn't conceiving, well, perhaps there's something they're doing that's not working. Let's look at the actual mechanics of the act. So that was a safe way to look at sexuality. And it wasn't really till the early 1900s that some brave souls, Robert Latou Dickinson, a gynecologist in the Bronx, got the idea to actually interview women and speak to them and talk to them about their sexuality and counsel them. So he was, to my mind, even more of a brave soul than Masters or Johnson or Kinsey.
Now, wait a minute. You want to talk about brave soul? You and your husband climbed in an MRI machine and had sex while being MRI'd.
Well, Even more brave than an MRI. See, an MRI would have been okay because you have some privacy, but we were actually being scanned with an ultrasound wand. And if listeners are familiar with ultrasound, that the pregnant woman will have the scan. So the researcher was right there within arm's length of us. And this was it was an extraordinarily awkward sexual experience, to say the least. It was more like one of those instances where you go to the hospital and you know there's going to be an awkwardness that will last about 15 minutes, and then it'll be over with and you'll go have a stiff drink. That's sort of what it came down to.
But the beauty of it is the courage that you had to do that. The courage mm-hmm. to say, come on, honey, let's go see what we can find out. It was not done for a thrill.
No, it was absolutely not done for a thrill, I can guarantee you that. Yeah. And the courage is much more on the part of my husband because, of course, the burden of performance is on him much more so than on myself. So hats off to Ed.
So let's talk about some of what you found. First, let's do a little history.
Yes.
The history of the science of sex, okay?
Sure. Well, if we go all the way back, the first instance of actually taking a scientist's eye and training it upon sex was that Leonardo did these wonderful figures, the coition figures, which essentially was a cutaway view of the genitals in sexual congress, essentially. And, of course, he had a few things wrong because he didn't really have a cadaver. You can't really use cadavers to study sexual intercourse. I suppose you could, but it would be quite logistically challenging. So he was really the first to really think, well, what is going on? Because, of course, it's taking place out of sight. And so that's as far back as I was able to trace the scientific study of sex. And then moving forward, you'd start to get into the world of fertility. And there was this whole era where this notion of upsuck or insuck was believed to exist. And this
was talk a little about the upsuck theory.
Sure. The theory is that when a woman has an orgasm, that the contractions serve to pull the semen up through the cervix and sort of quickly deliver it to the egg, thereby upping the odds.
So therefore, if a woman has an orgasm, she has more chances of becoming pregnant.
That was the theory, yes. Yes, and that was actually going way back, even as far as Hippocrates. There was an idea that orgasm was actually necessary for conception, that the woman had a bursting forth of seed just like the man did, because, of course, they couldn't see. They didn't know. And for many millennia, that was believed to be the case, and that was wonderful for women because physicians would counsel men, it's very important to pleasure the woman. The woman's orgasm was very, very important for centuries because it was believed to be necessary for conception. Then along came artificial insemination, and it was realized that, well, in fact, it's possible to get pregnant with absolutely no pleasure whatsoever. So, sadly, that was the end of the men be good to your ladies era of sexual theory. But upsuck is interesting because in animals there's evidence that it actually occurs, and there even in Denmark, to give you an example of how this has come into play, artificial inseminators actually will do some of the things that the boar would do. They'll do this to the sow while they artificially inseminate, and they find a 6% higher rate in the farrowing rate, which is the number of piglets produced if the sow is aroused. So, in fact, that's part of the technique of inseminators in Denmark, and it's an interesting thing to observe. I can tell you.
So fertility was one of the reasons to study.
Yes.
But the real reason to study is because it was dirty. The real reason to study is because people get thrills out of studying sex and then trying to quantify it, and then trying to stand back and say, "Oh, look at that! It's because of this that she has that." It's trying to objectify it in some way. It's really that sex is kind of an intriguing,
it is, yes,
pleasurable thing that people like to play with.
Yes.
Fantasy.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, people sometimes say, well, what are sex researchers like? Are they perverted, sexually obsessed people? And I say, no, sex researchers are people who had the good sense to choose to specialize in something that is utterly fascinating and will keep them interested for years and years. That's my view of sex
research. But you've been fascinated by sex long before you became a researcher.
In the same sense that everybody is fascinated with sex, don't you think?
No, I think you are wilder than everybody else. I have a sneaking suspicion that you had a good time out there, more than the average person who would be interested in sex. I think you said, you know, let me see what my freedom will bring me.
Mm-hmm, true.
You know?
That is true. That is true.
And so based on that, you were able to examine and see, okay, now where can I take myself?
Mm-hmm.
Where could I learn and what could I see about this?
Mm-hmm.
So you've studied. I mean, were you in California this whole time?
No, I was in Denmark. I was in London for the scan. I was in, actually, Cairo. There's a quite interesting researcher over there. And then all in different places in the U.S., so mostly in the United States. But
what did Marie Antoinette have to do with this?
Oh, Marie Bonaparte.
Bonaparte.
Marie Antoinette, I would love to hear a little about her sex life as well, but unfortunately I'm not privy to that information. But Marie Bonaparte.
You know, all the genealogy labs, they have a little speck of Marie Antoinette's genealogy. And they keep trying to compare everybody to Marie Antoinette.
Really?
So she's very famous, yes. they have a little piece of her DNA.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. They got it off of a comb or a brush
or something? Yeah, yeah. Right.
Wow, Marie.
She wore it like a relic, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Around your neck.
Around your neck.
Well, Marie Bonaparte was an interesting woman. She published a paper in 1917, I believe it was, that looked at the distance between the clitoris and the vagina and whether that distance played a role in sexual satisfaction in women, whether they had an orgasm during intercourse. Marie Bonaparte,
Mm-hmm. Slow me down. The distance between the clitoris and the vagina.
The vagina
being the vaginal opening.
Yes, yes.
And the clitoris being the thing above it.
Yes, yes.
Oh, that whole thing is not called a vagina?
No, the whole thing is a vulva.
I see.
But that's a confusing thing.
I mean,
thing. Yes, it
there
is.
I am.
I know. Yeah, you and everyone else. It's true. So the whole area, the whole external is the vulva. Thank you for pointing that out. So
now we want to know the distance.
Yeah. So the distance, right.
Right.
Now, if you had a very short distance, then it stands to reason the clitoris would be indirectly stimulated during intercourse more easily than if it were farther away, if you had a
longer span.
Marie believed, she had measured herself and a number of women she knew, and she dubbed herself a téléclitoridienne, which means in French, she of the distant clitoris.
Mm-hmm.
And she had this theory and actually did measurements on a number of women and published this paper and did find a correlation between the distance. In other words, the shorter the distance, the more likely the orgasm.
Well, that would make sense.
That would make sense. What didn't make quite as much sense is that Marie then went on to enlist the aid of a friend who was a surgeon, Joseph Halban, who surgically moved the tip of her clitoris. When I say tip, I say that because the bulk of the organ is beneath the surface, and you're just really relocating the part that protrudes. She had this operation not once but twice, which was a sad thing. Didn't have any success with it, but anyway, that was a case of one of the very rare early women who became a sex researcher, again, motivated by her own sexual state of affairs.
This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. As you may have gotten by now, Mary Roche has written a book called Bonk, B-O-N-K, which is a lot to do about sexual science. And we're going to be getting pretty graphic. If those of you who don't like this stuff, you know, because we're talking dirty, you may not want to listen in today. But we're going to be getting, we want to learn. And Mary has quite a bit to teach us. And I kid around when I say dirty, but, you know, it's like to many people listening, there are some people who say, oh, I don't want to hear this because it stimulates me. I don't want to hear this because it angers me. I don't want to hear this because it objectifies. So I want people to know that, you know, if you don't tune in today, or you could listen to it later on the Internet. But stick with us, because this is exciting stuff. Let's go, Mary.
Sure. Anyway, Marie Bonaparte was...
You put out. Do you know how long it takes for a man to have sex, for people to have sex? Usually it takes how long? How long is the average sexual experience?
You know, that's an interesting thing, because when the people ask the questions, they don't frame them very specifically. They'll say, how many thrusts is the average bout of sex?
All right, let's guess that one.
Yeah, what?
Are we talking about male thrusts?
Male thrusts.
Male thrusts as opposed to female thrusts.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, male thrusts as opposed to female pelvic movements.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So how many thrusting, and we know that men have to thrust,
mm-hmm.
how many thrusts do you think it takes for a man, and during an average sex, what do you guess, people? What do you guess, 10, 20, 2?
50?
50? Average 100 to 500 thrusts.
Is it really 100 to 500?
An average of 500, and it lasts 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, this is what's kind of funny. How can it last 2 minutes
exactly.
with 500 thrusts?
Well, and also...
You look like a jackrabbit.
A wind-up toy.
A wind-up toy.
Also, they're measuring the duration of sexual intercourse. Well, what about all the foreplay, the erotic massage, the half hour to 45 minutes of wonderful things that came before the thrusting? The thrusting, to me, is the crescendo, the last act, and I don't think you can call that the entire sexual act. So when the questions get asked, I think that they elicit the wrong answers sometimes.
How long does a woman's orgasm last?
There's a pretty wide range, but what's interesting is that there was a study done where women will invariably underestimate the duration of the orgasm by, 15 seconds? Was it? I don't have the statistic in front of me right now, but it's as though you lose track of time. Like time sort of expands or contracts, and you don't have any way to judge it. Women are way off in estimating how long their orgasm
and
lasts.
And usually that's about 25 seconds.
It lasts longer than you think. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more.
Sure. Well, on the topic of orgasm is always an interesting thing
sure.
to explore because, I mean, technically speaking, orgasm is a reflex of the autonomic nervous system, but the incredibly wide range of things that will trigger it was an eye-opener to me. Need no hands. You need not necessarily any sort of genital stimulation. It can be triggered just mentally, it can be triggered by Kinsey interviewed women who could just be triggered. An orgasm could be triggered by stroking the eyebrow, pressing on the teeth, all manner of idiosyncratic things.
Well, so orgasm doesn't involve clitoral stimulation only?
No, it doesn't need to. It doesn't need to. No. There are women. There's a study at Rutgers University. There was a researcher who was looking at bringing in women, and they're very rare, bringing in women who can use breath work or energy
sure.
work to trigger orgasm.
I've seen people who
yes.
are hypnotized into orgasm
yeah,
just by counting numbers.
It's extraordinary. I met a woman who actually, I had dinner with her, and she's quite adept at this. And I said, so could you do it right here in the restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, I could. I'd rather finish my dinner. But we went outside afterwards, and she sat on a bench and shut her eyes. It took her about a minute and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It was extraordinary. And you wouldn't know what was going on if you walked by. She sort of flushed and shuddered a little bit. And it was quite extraordinary. It took her 2 years to master the technique.
Do you know about orgasm during bowel movement? Is that something that's
yes.
familiar to you?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. I came across a paper called Defecation-Induced Orgasm, and it was a case study of a gentleman who every time he had a bowel movement, it would trigger an orgasm, sort of a crosstalk in the nervous system, because the two are, the sacral nerve root, it covers sexuality and defecation and urination, and sometimes the wires get crossed a little bit. An unusual scenario, but it exists, yeah.
I've known of it more in women
mm-hmm.
who have that. It's just like it's so close.
Yeah. I've never met someone who's had that, but it must be. And for these women, I'm curious, was it an annoyance, or did they enjoy it?
No, it was a great pleasure.
Yeah.
It was a great pleasure that having a bowel movement was a great sexual experience.
Isn't that nice? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case study of a woman who had an orgasm whenever she brushed her teeth.
Mm.
And the neurologists were puzzled by it. They tested the toothpaste to see if it was something. And the toothpaste, they stimulated the gums to see whether that was triggering it, but it was the sensory motor act of toothbrushing that would trigger, and it was a small seizure to relate. You know, something, a seizure in the same part of the brain was triggering this orgasm every time she brushed her teeth. I would have thought this woman would have excellent oral hygiene, brushing her teeth 2-3 times a day, but in fact she was a little freaked out by it and sought help for the situation.
Mary, tell us about what you found around the G-spot. I know that a lot of women have questions about that. Did you come across the research from Kinsey or any of the other things?
The G-spot is fascinating because, you know, the whole question of, is there such a thing as a vaginal orgasm? And in that case, you have to define, are you talking about an orgasm from stimulating the G-spot, or are you talking about just from the friction of in and out straight-on missionary intercourse, which doesn't really hit the G-spot very efficiently? So when people say, oh, there's no such thing as vaginal orgasm, often they're talking about intercourse that wouldn't be really stimulating the G-spot. But, of course, there's lots of ways to have intercourse and certainly to bring the G-spot into play. The G-spot's interesting in that it seems to be located in different parts of the front wall of the vagina. I've heard it's not a differentiated kind of cell. You hear about, oh, there's these surgical procedures to enhance the G-spot. And this is new since I researched the book, and I don't know how that's done, because my understanding was that the G-spot is just a variable erogenous area on the front wall of the vagina, front being toward the belly.
One of the most recent researches was that there's a purpose for it. And the purpose is not for sexual pleasure, but when the baby is traveling down the canal, it presses into that spot and therefore provides the mother with an orgasm as the child is being born. Now think about the difference that this makes in the bonding.
Oh, yes.
Of what happens. So in other words, its purpose was not for having sex.
Right.
But for childbirth.
That makes perfect sense. Hear about orgasm during childbirth is a pretty common thing. And then you would get the release of oxytocin, which would be a bonding experience. That's perfect sense.
Makes you like your kids a lot more.
Yeah, you forget about the pain they just put you through.
Can you talk about the other parts of what you found with Kinsey and Masters and Johnson? I found that section revealing that this isn't really well known. When people read the books, they just see the clinical side. What interesting things did you find with them?
Well, Kinsey was an interesting case. I was looking at researchers who were studying the nuts and bolts of physiology and arousal and orgasm. Kinsey's known best for his encyclopedic interviews with couples, with men and women in the 40s, everything that they do in their sex life, how often they do it, how they do it, etc. But he also became interested in the physiology. But in the 40s, it was a little too early to bring people into a laboratory openly. So what happened, he had a setup in his attic that he and his staff were actually the subjects. And it's an area of Kinsey's oeuvre that is a little controversial, because there were those who said that some of the staff were not feeling comfortable with the situation of having, you know, being filmed in this way, having sex. So it was quite a, and he, you know, even the Kinsey Institute refers to the films as the Kinsey Stag films. They exist in the archives there at the Kinsey
Institute. Quite a beautiful movie about it, though. Did you see?
Yes, yes. I thought
that
it's very close to the biography,
right,
which was very well done. They've certainly played down some of the more, you know, his
sure.
more the masochism and the experiment, his personal sexual proclivities. But I thought it was a beautifully done movie that really highlighted what an amazing thing he did for men and women in that era, to say this is the whole scope of human sexuality. This is what everybody's doing. A lot more people are doing it than you think. There are people having homosexual sex. Women are having multiple orgasms. People are looking at pornography. They're doing all this stuff. You're not the only person, and it's all normal, and it's all okay. And that was a tremendous relief to millions of people. So to my mind, he was really quite a hero. And to have done that at that time.
And Masters and Johnson's, what were you feeling about their work?
Masters and Johnson also, they were the first. They took the attic sessions and sort of legitimized. They had a whole laboratory at Washington University in St. Louis. They actually had an openly funded program to bring men and women into the lab to study arousal, the different phases of arousal and orgasm, in a systematic way. And 700 men and women came into that lab and were studied in very intimate, demanding ways. I mean, this is not a study where, you know, you watch some pornographic clips and someone measures how aroused you are. This was, they wanted to study orgasm, so the performance anxiety, I would think, would have been tremendous to come into a lab as a couple or as a one person masturbating and to have someone filming and taking notes and documenting the entire process was, especially in that time period, incredible. It was an incredible thing that they did. Masters later wrote in one of his papers that when the book came out, Human Sexual Response, he said, we had to hire a secretary to handle all the hate mail. And this was a book, it was written so scientifically. They were so careful to use scientific terms. There was nothing titillating. They'd say, if a man couldn't get it up, it was a failure of erective performance. If a woman had an orgasm half the time she had sex, it was a 50% orgasmic return. It was very, very legitimate scientific stuff. They really went out of their way not to seem like they were doing something prurient or voyeuristic, and yet the response was quite heated.
Well, Mary, it must feel very sad for you to see people in their confusion and their hatred around sex.
It is very sad. But yes, I remember when I started working on Bonk, I was listening to All Things Considered, and there was an interview with the director of the film, Kinsey, and he was talking about how the very, very conservative elements of the Christian right had tried to prevent the film from even being produced. They had staged pickets outside the movie theaters, and this was a gentle version of Kinsey's life. Kinsey is just such a flashpoint for conservatives, and it's so sad to me that he has been vilified in this way by such a large percentage of the population when really he was just trying to help people. Yeah.
People, when they're children, they have all kinds of attitudes, feelings, projections. It's painful what we do with our children around sex.
Mm-hmm.
It's painful. And most people grow up believing that they should know everything.
Yes.
You know, you're supposed to know it.
Oh, and you don't. There was a wonderful example I mentioned earlier, Robert Latou Dickinson, that very early, he's the guy who got Kinsey interested in sex research. He was a gynecologist in the New York area. And he wrote about, because he interviewed people about their sex lives when they came into his practice, and he said there were something like 20 couples who he'd seen who didn't realize that the penis goes further than the outer labia, that they were just trying to have intercourse in the cleft of the labia and not understanding, well, why can't we get pregnant? And Dickinson would ask questions. He was one of the first MDs to really say, well, what are you doing? Can you describe it in detail? What's going on? And it turned out that these men and women didn't actually know how to have sex, or the woman didn't know to open her legs because you had no information. You couldn't ask anyone. Parents never spoke of it. So it was a sad, and he got involved. His motivation was that he saw so many marriages destroyed by dissatisfying sex.
Well, even today, people can't talk about it. They come to us,
yes,
and we open the conversation, and it's like they've never spoken about what they need and what they feel. Do you find that, Stephanie?
I still see that, exactly. The couples are intimidated, afraid. They feel vulnerable. They don't even know their own anatomy or their own responses and what would give them pleasure. So I educate them. I give them information. I'll help them explore what might work for the two of you. What in your, ability to communicate, what can you say to each other that would ease this process?
And
it's talking exploration.
About it, talking about it itself is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Just being able to talk about it. This is Armand DeMille. My guest is Mary Roach, author of Bonk. My co-host and assistant is Stephanie Dombra. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little music, and we're going to continue with more about the sex research. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes.
Despertar
And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Mary Roach, author of Bonk, Stephanie Dombra. We're talking about human sexuality and human science. The science of human sexuality and all the science that takes place. Let's talk about these two words. And these are tough words here, Mary. One is, I would never use the word frigidity. That would, you know, you get stoned for that one. But non-orgasmic response, non-erectile. Men don't get erections. Women don't feel stimulated. Mm-hmm. Women don't feel aroused. Can we talk a little about that?
Sure, absolutely, yes. And that is that's also the fact that it's, for men, it's a technical erection difficulty. For women, it's almost more of a state of mind and emotional thing. But the interplay between the two leads to a lot of psychological difficulties.
You know, there's a little bit of a myth behind that too, because I run men's groups, and I have a lot of men who say they could have easy erections, but they don't feel anything.
Really?
They have sex and they don't feel.
Well, it's interesting. People don't realize all that the functions are separate. You can have an orgasm without ejaculation. You can have ejaculation without You can have an orgasm without erection.
You can have an orgasm without pleasure.
They're discrete pieces of a puzzle, and you tend to think that they all happen all at once, and if you have one, you have all of them, which isn't the case. It's fascinating.
So what are we learning about? What have we learned about this inhibitory response? The fact that some people feel it and some people don't. One of the nice pieces of research I remember was about people who lose sensation, men who lose sensation in their penises, after a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a researcher in Birmingham, Alabama, Marka Lisipsky, and she studies orgasm and arousal in people with spinal cord injuries, and it's been fascinating because she's been able to trace the different pathways of pleasure. And there are people with spinal cord injury, depending on where it is on the spine, they have orgasm, but they may not feel it. Some of them have it and feel it. Others, if the sacral root is damaged way down at the base of the spine, they may have no response at all. But for the most of them, they can conceive children because they can get an erection. They can even have an orgasm, though they may not. It may not feel the same.
And the orgasm may be an ejaculate.
Yes. Yes.
But not necessarily orgasm in the full sense of the word.
It may not feel like an orgasm, but there's ejaculation. Yes.
Do women have orgasms that they don't know about?
I don't know of any instance where a woman has the muscular contractions, but she can't feel it.
I think I've heard women say, I don't know if I had an orgasm or not.
Yeah, I think my guess is that that's because if they've never had it, they don't know what they're supposed to feel. I think if they'd had it, they would say, hey, that's got to be an orgasm.
Do you find that true, Stephanie?
I would guess that.
Yes. Yes, I have heard women tell me that. For sure.
Now, you've counseled a lot of women who come to you innocently trying to talk about their sexuality. And, I mean, they must ask you the most amazing, innocent questions.
I wind up doing the asking, Armand.
What do you ask?
Well, a lot of people are inhibited about talking about these things. So often I will have to ask probing questions and get very specific with people so that I can also get the information. What do they understand about, again, those ideas of orgasm? Are they expecting to orgasm during intercourse? Are they expecting, you know, that it's just supposed to happen naturally without any stimulation to the clitoris? All these things
there's a big deal. See, as a therapist, when you communicate with a woman about her sexuality, you're also stepping into a role of a mother who is making it okay for her child to have a sexuality. Because so often in life, mothers, in a way, want their children not to have a sexuality, and they want to inhibit it. And the child passively picks up this message. So when they consult with you, and they talk to you, and you say it's okay, it's okay. A big thing happens.
And a lot of clients will actually tell me about their grandkids that are masturbating and touching themselves, and I validate that this is perfectly normal. And usually those parents, and many times it's religious parents, they're very fearful that their daughter is being aroused and stimulated. They'll tell them, don't do that. You know, they're always getting their hands away from their bodies. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on there that's misinformation.
The delicacy of a woman being able to communicate with you about her sexuality is essential. This is great. Being able to pick up a book like Bonk and being able to learn about it helps heal the wound. Why are parents so inhibitory about their children's sexuality? What do you think, Mary?
Well, I think you made a wonderful point saying that, in a way, it's a threat to the parent-child bond because it means it's this tremendous intimacy with someone other than the parent, and that's perhaps frightening. You
that's
know more
one.
Than me.
That's
yeah.
one, and then there's competition, too.
Yes, very much so. So I'm guessing that it's with parents and, yeah, it's a competition for love.
For a woman,
yes,
a mother with her daughter, and the daughter has daddy involved here.
Yes.
Right? In a way, I don't want you to be a sexual being because daddy is mine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there's this unconscious message that your sex is bad.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah. I'm a step-parent, and I can recall when my stepdaughters were just becoming teenagers. They were, you know, when they were around 13 years old, this sense that I was having an affair behind their back. I was having an affair with their dad. It was this very straight forward competition for intimacy and love, and it's a very awkward scenario, and I understand why it's threatening to a child and why a parent tries to hide the sex and take it out of the equation.
So sex itself is not the big deal. It's the way that we deal with it, you know what I mean? Could you tell me about some of the discrepancies we don't understand about sex, for example? The thing about men who have sex and then they turn away, can you explain that? Why does that take place? Women want seem to want more intimacy after sex.
Right, right.
Could you talk about that?
You were talking about prolactin and that there's a release of prolactin, but you know more about that than I do.
Stephanie, what about it?
Well, we've come to understand a lot of physiology goes into our behaviors, and of course they are also involved with our sexual behaviors. So after a couple is intimate and they have intercourse and they orgasm, another set of chemistry takes place. Another set of chemicals are released, and one of the chemicals is prolactin. After orgasm, prolactin increases. And for some, maybe evolutionary reason, it's built in to turn away. So men who orgasm and then turn away from their partners, and there are women that do the same thing, they will turn away instead of cuddling and having that wonderful bonding experience.
Well, why would that be? I mean, if oxytocin becomes a natural bonding product, they would want to bond. Why would you turn away?
It's the
evolutionary reasons.
Well, is it the case that there's more prolactin in men? There's more of a release of prolactin in men versus women? Is that the situation?
More prolactin than oxytocin. Mm-hmm. That's the
in men.
In men.
That's what happens. Well, it would make sense because the man wants to spread his seed far and wide.
He wants to leave and go off to the next.
And the woman wants to keep him around to help her raise the child.
But if you're an average woman who feels like she's just made love to somebody and she wants to get close to him and he turns his back, you make him wrong. You say, what's the matter with you? And he feels bad.
Right.
He says, I don't know why I want to get out of this bed, but I just gotta go get a pizza.
Right, exactly. And that's where information is power. And knowing it helps. It just helps a relationship for two parties to have some kind of understanding. It's not a personal issue. It's just physiology.
Well, let's say that we accepted that this was okay. Imagine a creative couple, right? Saying, okay, sure, you want to turn away. I think I'll move on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Right, right. Well,
or I'll go get you a pizza.
Yeah, don't make it a big thing.
Let's not make it a big deal. People make
yes, no,
so
I know.
Much a big
With
deal.
Sex, that's you know. For example, if you have a situation where there's a couple and for one reason or another, the man loses his erection. Two ways you can go. The man can go, oh my God, I have ED, and get very upset about it, panic, think I'm going to need to take drugs or something wrong with me. Then the next time they have sex, he's anxious, he's worried. That'll knock it out right there.
And it starts the cycle.
Yeah, the other thing that you could do is just make a joke about it and go, you know what, it happens all the time. You're like, or make a Bob Dole joke and move on, and it doesn't become a big deal.
So what you're basically saying is that if people are allowed to talk to each other about sex and they're allowed to really communicate and learn, there's a lot more stuff they can learn about. Okay, so we have prolactin, we have oxytocin. Could you give me a little information about dopamine and sex?
I don't know that much about dopamine and sex, actually.
Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that is involved with pleasure. So any anticipation of a pleasurable experience increases our dopamine in our brain. So if we're getting ready to be intimate and sexual and we're aroused, dopamine is aroused. Testosterone is aroused in both men and women. So all these chemicals are flooding us during that sexual arousal. During orgasm is a big blast of dopamine, and then the dopamine decreases and oxytocin and prolactin increases. So there's a lot of things that go into our pleasure.
When a couple has a strong relationship, they learn to talk to each other about sex. When most couples don't talk to each other about sex, they're kind of doomed. It's kind of like it goes away.
Yeah.
This whole idea of the silent, quiet, non-sexual relationship. Can you talk to me about that?
Well, I think it's epidemic. I think I don't have the actual figures, but I think it's very common that after a couple, they have children, number of years have gone by, and especially right after having children, the woman loses an interest in, she has other things on her mind, and sex becomes less important, and it can sort of spiral down to the point where the woman would be fine if they never had sex again, or she feels that
I'd rather
eat chocolate, and the man feels very frustrated. And if they don't talk about it, then the longer you don't talk about it, the more of an issue it becomes, and the more difficult it is to bring it up, and it spirals down, and to the point where the man seeks pleasure elsewhere, or the whole thing falls apart. And I think it happens all the time.
Well, when a woman goes through menopause, does she lose sexual interest in general?
The interest of the libido drops. It's a hormonal scenario.
And testosterone drops.
Yeah, testosterone,
estrogen, all those things.
Yeah, and that's why there was a patch, a very very low dose testosterone patch for women called Intrinza that was all set to be FDA approved, and then what happened? We had the, remember when hormone replacement therapy suddenly became something that was very dangerous and to be discouraged? Well, the FDA then became skittish about hormones in general, wanted much more long-term safety data on low-dose testosterone in women, so it's not available. It is in Europe. I think you can probably get it on the Internet, or a doctor can prescribe it, something from a compounder. Just a very low dose of testosterone will boost libido. And in postmenopausal women, a lot of postmenopausal women feel that they're not the person they used to be. They don't have the same drive that they had, and it's upsetting or troubling, and sometimes that can help.
Is it upsetting and troubling because it's really upsetting and troubling them, or do they just want to be able to respond for their mates?
I think very often it's the latter, but sometimes the former. Stephanie, you would know more about what women come to you.
I think it's a combination. If it's just the sex drive, sometimes women don't get bothered by that unless their partner is asking them. But a lot of times during menopause, the energy, their dryness, their whole sense of well-being is kind of at stake. So they also feel uncomfortable enough to do something. It's not just somebody asking them, please take interest in sex and do something about our sex.
So when you go through menopause and you lose aspects of your sexuality, it's not just sexuality you're losing. You're losing a whole sense of self.
Yeah, vitality is what they're losing. They want to feel vital again.
But do they want to feel it, or would some people just settle into not being vital? Like, I know a lot of men.
I know a lot of
men who are crazed, sex crazed their whole lives. And then they get through a certain age, and they say, oh, thank God I'm not that way anymore.
Yeah, you have to ask the question, is it just our cultural expectations that human beings will be sexual until they're 90, or is it actually something that people are missing, or do they feel there's something wrong with me, I no longer feel sexual? Because in a way we're creating an illness out of a natural consequence of aging.
Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, you remember who he was?
I sure do, yes.
I thought
yes,
you were.
The red clothing,
orange.
Yes. Orange, red and orange, yeah. I had neighbors upstairs who were
sannyasin.
Yeah,
sannyasin.
Sannyasin.
Huh? Bhagwan was very interesting around sex because he did a lot of research. He said something fascinating about sex when someone asked him, and he was running communes where were having sex like crazy, and he said he had given up sex. And people said, well, how could you, who talk so much about the beauty of sex, have given up sex? And he said, you can't give up sex if you've never owned it. He said, you must have the right to your sexuality. He said, then after a while, when you feel like you really have it, then you may choose to say, that's enough of that.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And that's,
but never give up. He said, you can never give up something you've never had.
Yeah.
And a lot of people we know give up sex, but they've never had it.
Yeah, and therefore they're frustrated and they feel that they're missing a big component of their lives. And that's interesting. Didn't know about the Bhagwan.
Yeah, right upstairs from your house, right?
Yeah, that's right. He switched from sex to collecting Rolls Royces. I had.
Armand DeMille here. We're with Mary Roche. Mary, if something in your in adult life, in the later life, as people get older, is there a period at which sex becomes funny with advanced age, like in the 80s and stuff like that?
My sense of sex as we age is basically, in a nutshell, the men get soft and the women get dry. And that's a disappointing thing. But there are pharmaceutical remedies to those two things. But setting that aside, my understanding is that people can continue to have sexually fulfilling lives well into their 80s and 90s. Wasn't there recently a story about sexually transmitted diseases in nursing homes being a problem? So obviously people are still, you know, enjoying new love and sexuality in their well into their 80s. And probably they always have. It's just, when you're a kid, you think, oh, my God, my parents and 40-year-old people having sex, that's disgusting. And then as you age, you think, I don't know, I could picture it, 80-year-olds having sex, why not?
Yeah, I wonder where that thought of ours, that an adult, an older adult, being sexual is wrong.
We have it like the
dirty old man. We have this image that people who are past 60 should not be allowed to have sex.
We do, yes.
Maybe it's some kind of a cultural thing that we have. You know, which you're not supposed to compete with the young kids.
Yeah, you leave the fun to the young kids. Yeah. We have such a youth-obsessed culture now that I think that contributes to it. But it's always been there for one reason or another. It's never been the case that you could, in advertising a product, show an older couple. Even Viagra, you show the couple dancing. They're never doing anything actually sexual. You would think this is a drug to enhance dancing in middle age.
That's what the commercials tell us, right?
Yeah, it's a shameful thing. Over 50.
Are you going to continue this research with Bunk?
I have a pretty short attention span. I tend to completely switch directions. After Stiff, I went on to some paranormal research and then sex, and now I'm moving completely in another direction.
And what's your next book going
to
be?
It has to do with space and research into what happens to human beings living without gravity or air, and how do you possibly pull that off, and what would happen if you sent people on a 2-year mission into space to Mars, and what kind of surreal things might develop.
You know, that's not so far from dealing with sexuality.
No, it's not.
It isn't. I mean, it's the same mind of yours.
You're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Thank you for seeing that, Armand.
Yes.
You're a very, very perceptive man.
So this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Our guest, Mary Roche, the book Bunk, in paperback, available, B-O-N-K. Fascinating, funny. Stephanie, you couldn't stop laughing, right?
I really haven't belly laughed reading a book in a very long time, since maybe David Sedaris's book.
Oh, thank you. Putting me in the same sentence with him,
Mary,
thank you.
That's how much I laughed. You get information, it's entertaining, it's academic, and it's informative. It's great.
Thank you.
Be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. This is Armand DeMille. Special thanks to my two guests. And, back with you tomorrow.